Ready.
Okay, the Fish and Wildlife Commission has come back from an abbreviated lunch. We're here now for agenda item 7. This is a blue sheet, pinniped conservation and management. This is a briefing. The blue sheet was submitted by Commissioner Anderson. Commissioner Anderson, you have the floor.
Okay, thank you very much. This is a very important and pertinent topic. I think it gets to the heart of much of what we're trying to accomplish in the region. Salmon recovery, orca recovery are critical, and pinnipeds are a factor in that. I think if we ever hope to get to recovery and delisting, that we do need to have a very serious plank with regard to predation from pinnipeds. I think the stakes are high. We spend millions of dollars on salmon recovery through habitat work, through flows. And we've had some success and we've made some progress. There's some good stuff we're going to hear about pinniped work on the Columbia River. And there have been some things in Puget Sound that have been positive. But really, except in certain locations, we still have some serious things to talk about with regard to pinnipeds. And by that, you know, we mean sea lions and harbor seals. So that's why I asked for a blue sheet a few months back, so that we would have an opportunity to have a discussion at the commission level, that we would be able to bring together what we know and what's going on to talk about kind of the framework that is out there, and to more specifically try to find out where there's areas where we can make some good progress, a scientific approach, both in the short term and the long term, one that is maybe doing some things as we're trying to perfect our knowledge. So, you know, there may be ways that we can do some non-lethal deterrent in order to save some of these runs. We've got some critical limiting stocks that are affecting our fisheries, and I'm particularly thinking about still Aguamish, but there are other areas, and that those are major constraints on the Chinook fishery. We heard this morning about the winter blackmouth and the impact north of Falcon decisions have made on that particular fishery. And it gets to the heart of what we can do, or what we're seeing coming back in these river systems, some of which are habitat related, some of which are predation related, some of which are harvest related. But this is an area where we can talk about pinnipeds and try to get a better understanding and figure out what we can do. So with that, I'll just turn it over and go from there.
Jim, that was a great introduction. Okay, Nate and crew.
Great. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, Director Susewin. My name is Nate Pamplin. I'm the Director of Budget and Government Affairs with the department. And today I'm joined by Cassina Lee, who's the Southwest Washington Region Director for Region 5, Dr. Scott Pearson, who's a senior wildlife scientist in our wildlife program. He manages the West Side Western Washington research team. And then Dr. Joe Anderson, who is a senior fish scientist in our fish program, has been working with you on a number of other projects. You'll see Joe a lot. He's incredible. So we got a great team today, a good topic. Commissioner Anderson, thank you for inviting this briefing. This is something we're getting asked to engage on a lot. There was two recommendations in the governor's Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force that directed agencies to look at pinniped predation. The commission has a position statement that was adopted a couple years ago, directing us to look at this issue. There's a bill in the legislature right now. We have a number of budget requests dealing with this issue. Dr. Pearson and I had a Senate work session last Thursday. So there's a lot of interest in this topic. And so it's nice to be able to actually slow down and use this as a forum, because it's not only just the eight of you as commissioners, but we also know there's a lot of other people that are tracking this issue. And so it's a nice opportunity to kind of share the latest and greatest of what we're doing within the department. So Scott, would you mind sharing your screen? And let's see here. So the next slide, we'll just present the outline here once we go on. So what we'll do is we're going to start with a quick overview of the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Then we'll have Dr. Pearson walk through the status of pinniped stocks in Washington. Cassina will provide an update of all the things that we've got going on in the Columbia River. And then we'll turn to Scott and Joe to provide an update on the Puget Sound diet studies that we've been doing and analyzing the data collected from 2016 through 18. And then I'll close out the presentation just talking about some next steps. Next slide, please. So to start with just a quick overview of the Marine Mammal Protection Act. You know, it was passed in 1972. Really the emphasis here that I wanna say is it's the Protection Act. It's not the Marine Mammal Management Act. It's not even the Marine Mammal Conservation Act. It is the Protection Act. And in the early 70s, you know, the great whale populations were in demise, dolphins were being incidentally caught in tuna fisheries, pinniped populations were depressed. So a lot of interest in figuring out ways to protect and provide some relief for marine mammal populations and recognizing the unique role that they have, not only in ecosystems, but also in terms of capturing human interest. Next slide, please. So the MMPA requires, depending on the species, the National Marine Fisheries Service or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to maintain species or stocks, so kind of borrowing a fisheries term, at their optimum sustainable population size and to be a significant functioning element in the ecosystem. So it's really to restore depleted stocks, as well as there's some provisions for different types of take. A big chunk of the MMPA is about also reducing bycatch and injury of marine mammals caught incidentally to commercial fisheries. Next slide. The MMPA starts with a thou shalt not take, and take is not necessarily just killing a marine mammal. Take can also be harassing a marine mammal, capturing a marine mammal, or attempting to do any of those items. So we have scientific collection permits, for instance, because we might have takes just when we do a low-level flight over a harbor seal haul out and a few harbor seals are bounced off the rocks. That is a take, and we document that and report that to the National Marine Fisheries Service. Next slide, please. I share this slide because oftentimes in this topic, what we hear is a frustration about an exploding population of California sea lions or harbor seals. And, you know, why aren't we just doing something about it? Well, there's a lot to unpack there, but really wanted to slow down here and just talk about what are the options under the Federal Marine Mammal Protection Act. They're few and far between, and they really haven't been pursued. So individuals or agencies can apply for a waiver and request a direct take permit. In about the 50 years of the Marine Mammal Protection Act, I believe NMFS has received less than 10 of those across all species for a variety of different types of take. In a previous career, I worked for the Macaw tribe. In 2005, I co-authored an application for an MMPA waiver for whaling. That permit's now been under review for the past 16 years. And has had two environmental impact statements, an administrative law judge hearing, and there's still not an answer. So just wanting to share that there's an extensive amount of process that is done under this particular avenue under the MMPA. There's a section 109 in the act that says, well, the state can ask a return of management authority. This has never been done. Alaska pursued it shortly after the act was adopted, did not go through. This would be returning authority, not just for the take, but it's for the management of the stock or for the species. So for instance, if the state had management authority over harbor seals, there'd be four stocks, and it wouldn't just be the perhaps the interest in managing predator-prey relationships, but it'd also be if the Navy had a development on one of their installations that resulted in take of harbor seals, we would then be the agency reviewing and authorizing that level of take. The third avenue is one Cassina is going to be talking about in more detail, that's Section 120. And in 2018, Congress added a new section, a part of 120F. And this really just allows for the lethal taking of individually identifiable pinnipeds, which are having a documented impact on the recovery of listed salmon. So this was, you know, implemented after Ballard. It's the permit we've used in the Columbia River. 120F allows for something very unique in the Columbia River that says if sea lions are upstream of River Mile 112, they meet the definition of being individually identifiable. So you're already 112 miles away from the ocean. We kind of know what you're up to. So, and then lastly, just call out that we have pretty wide authorities to also pursue non-lethal management of nuisance animals. On this, it's not so much we need a permit. We have the authority. Of course, we work with NIMS to let them know what we're doing, when we're using it, making sure that they're okay with the approach. And then we proceed with the action. Next slide. So under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, there's a provision that puts a ceiling on the total human-caused mortality of marine mammals. And that's called the potential biological removal. You'll see that it's a function of the minimum population estimate. So it's not the mean, it's not the estimate, it's the minimum population estimate. Then it's you take the theoretical net productivity rate and you divide that in half. And then you apply a recovery factor depending on the ESA status of the species or what we know about the stock. So in each time, it's a very conservative estimate. And it's for the totality, again, of all human-caused mortality. So I'll hear folks say, well, why don't you just apply for a permit for the full PBR? And it's like, well, you need to account for there might be other provisions where there's incidental catches in fisheries or some other instances of mortalities that you'd want to make sure are allowed to be accounted for so that there's not a more stringent restrictions across the board. Next slide. So I'll turn it over to Scott to talk about the pinnipeds in the state.
Good afternoon. Can you folks hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Yep. Pleasure to be here this afternoon with you. I'm just going to do a quick introduction to the pinnipeds of Washington. And I'm going to focus on the big three, recognizing that we do have pupping elephant seals. We have northern fur seals on our coast regularly. We have Guadalupe fur seals, but we're going to really just focus on these three, the harbor seal, the California sea lion, and the stellar sea lion. The California sea lion is primarily present in Washington waters from September to April when it's not pupping. And it's a single U.S. stock. And as you can see here on the right, the diagram on the right will be consistent among these next few slides. And they show haulouts and give you the relative abundance on haulouts and how many animals will be there, the darker colors being more abundant and the lighter color being less abundant. So you can see they're found down along the Columbia River on the northern Washington coast, and then fairly moderate abundance through central and northern Puget Sound, and then fewer in southern Puget Sound. And their numbers had increased dramatically after the MMPA was established. And eventually that's reached an asymptote or leveled off. And it's now at that optimal population level that Nate just talked about. And you can see that in general, I don't know if you can see my cursor, but in recent years, it's been pretty flat. Numbers bounce around a bit, but the population's been fairly flat. Moving on to stellar sea lion. What's primarily present in Washington waters between September and April in the intermarine waters. It's found year round on the Washington coast now because we now have an active rookery, which we didn't in the past. And it's found on the Bonneville Lower Columbia River from late August to May. Washington Stellars belong to the Eastern Distinct Population segment, which ranges along the west coast of North America from Southeast Alaska to Central California. And this segment was delisted under the Endangered Species Act. Oh, in terms of its distribution, very similar to what you saw with the California sea lion in terms of where you find it. Really don't see very many of these animals in South Sound, but you find them in Central, North Sound, San Juan's, Northern Outer Coast, and of course on the Columbia River. And their numbers have been growing and appear to be continuing to grow over time and have not reached that asymptote or leveling off. Moving on to the harbor seal, it's a year-round resident, breeds locally. There's one coastal stock, and that's really a Washington, Oregon stock. It's not just a Washington stock. And the numbers I'm presenting here are from our most recent work. Then there is a northern inland stock, and you can see that includes the Strait of Juan de Fuca, the San Juan Archipelago, and northern Puget Sound, where there's quite a few animals, as you can see by that cluster of haulouts. Then there's a Hood Canal stock, and then eventually there are further to the south is a South Sound stock. And one key assumption on all of our estimates right now is we're using a correction factor. So we do aerial surveys for these animals. We count how many are on haulouts during a specific time of year when we would have maximum numbers at specific tide heights. And then we correct those numbers by how many are presumed to be in the water based on a bunch of telemetry information, which is from the 1990s. So that data is a bit dated. We would like to update that effort. So where are we with the stock assessment for harbor seal? It's a collaborative effort between NOAA, the tribes, and us. We completed our surveys in 2019, and that was funded by the local, our co-managers. And then all the data was assembled and proofed into a single data set. And then Jeff Lake was brought out of retirement on a contract through NOAA to complete the statistical analysis, which he did. And then right now I am working with Casey, another DFW employee, a brand new DFW employee who's now our new lead marine mammal researcher, on getting that stock assessment completed and into a manuscript, and it will actually be submitted to a peer-reviewed journal. And what have we found? We found that in general, the stocks are showing this logistic growth where they grew dramatically from after the act was enacted. And then in general, we find this leveling off. So here's the coastal stock. You can see that it leveled off quite a while ago, before 2000, and has been fairly stable since. Here we're looking at the northern inland water stock. There's some variation depending on we divide this up into spaces based on how we survey, but it's this bottom graph that you really need to focus on. And you can see again that leveled off, it appeared to level off quite a while ago in the 1990s and has been quite stable since, or bounces around, but no indication of a growing population. South Puget Sound, interestingly, appears to have reached its asymptote much later than all the other stocks. So it appeared to have grown for over a longer period of time. But in general, we're seeing that the population has been quite stable since 2008 or so. And then Hood Canal, we can't fit a logistic model. And that's because we don't really have good early data from the 1980s and 70s. We tried to get some data and we couldn't get it in the right format. We think that the population grew prior to 1990 and has been stable since. So conclusions on this, we completed the 2019 surveys, analysis were completed and estimates were derived. The stock assessment's in progress and that will be a peer-reviewed paper and hopefully that will be accepted by NOAA as their stock assessment. And in general, we're seeing that South Puget Sound, northern inland, and the Washington portion of the Washington-Oregon coastal stocks are at that optimal sustainable population levels that Nate talked about. And now we can actually calculate potential biological removal. And so with that, I'm going to pass this on to Cassina.
I have a quick question if I could.
Sure.
The distinction between stocks, coast, straight, north sounds, or or South Sound Hood Canal. What is the basis for that distinction? Is it a genetic difference? Is it a, how did you come to that?
Well, I didn't personally come to that. That was derived by NOAA, and it's based on a paper by Harriet Huber et al., which I'd be happy to share with you, and suggests there is some genetic structuring in this space that would suggest there's strong phylopatry. So that in terms of pupping, that animals are returning to those same haulouts to pup. And as a result, you end up with some genetic structure. And I think some people have questions about that and whether or not that should be revisited or not.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Scott, if I may, Commissioner Kuntz has his hand up, please.
Yeah. Before we go on, I'm just not familiar with the term optimal sustainable population, OSP. Could you please say what makes it optimal? Thanks.
I can do this one.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Kuntz, Scott, would you go back to the California sea lion graph, please? Yeah. So OSP is a term used in the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and it's essentially the population. The goal of the act is to maintain the population between the carrying capacity and the maximum net productivity level, which is that inflection point that you'll see there, generally, you know, roughly half of K. And so NMFS and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service needs to keep the stocks between that level. If it's below OSP, then there's even further restrictions on what can be done under already what's the Protection Act. So in general, you can't look at egg permits until the population is within that OSP range.
So the OSP range is the entire range between K and half of K?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. I think I'm up. So good afternoon, Chair Carpenter, Commission. So now that you've had some, Cassina Lee, apologies, Southwest Regional Director, and I've been working on this issue. So I've been with the agency for about 2.5 years and have been working on this issue for the department that entire time. In a prior life, I worked on sea lion issues, marine mammal strandings in Southern Oregon and the Washington coast, and was aware of this issue and have been tracking it for many years. So happy to be here to talk to you about this. And so now that you know, have that background on the two species and some of the MMPA, let's talk about this, the specific problem here in the Columbia. So when you see the image before you here, River Mile 145, Bonneville Dam is kind of ground zero for this problem in the Columbia River of sea lion predation. It's the first impoundment on the main stem Columbia, but any of these types of impoundments where fish bottleneck and have to stage up create opportunities for sea lions to have an outsized impact on those runs. Next slide, Scott. So what you're seeing here is the increase in the number of California sea lions at East Mooring Basin in Astoria at the mouth of the Columbia over about 20 years. So the docks at East Mooring Basin are a haulout that's heavily used by California sea lions in particular. You can see in 2005 and 2006, the maximum number was about 250 animals. So you'll see there's an order of magnitude difference on the vertical axis here of these two insets. So 10 years later, that maximum was almost 4,000 animals. And the same thing is true at Bonneville Dam. So in the 1980s, there were one or two California sea lions observed. In 2001, you had up to six at one time. And then by 2002, the Corps had estimates of about 30 California sea lions foraging at the dam for salmonids between January and May. So we haven't seen that 4,000 number that we see at the mouth. All of those animals don't go up to the dam, but a proportion of them do. Next slide. So recruitment of California sea lions at both Bonneville and at Willamette Falls in Oregon has been increasing over the last 15 to 20 years. And more recently, we've seen animals expanding into the tributaries as well. We think it's likely primarily the same animals from the dam and the falls that are making these foraging trips into the tributaries rather than additional animals. But because those trips contain spawning habitat of listed fish, this is something we're paying attention to. And you can see the observations in the various tributaries in this table that we provided with our application to NIMS for our Section 120F removal. Next slide. So the presence of stellar sea lions at Bonneville Dam has increased from a minimum of 3 animals in 2003 when they were first documented to a minimum of 89 in 2011. In 2018, a maximum of 66 stellar sea lions were observed at Bonneville Dam in a single day. So again, that increase over time. The presence of stellar sea lions at Bonneville has increased to the point that they're now present for more months of the year and are consuming higher proportions of the run than our California sea lions. Next slide.
Christina, yeah. Can I ask you a question if you don't mind?
Absolutely.
Is it just the stellars that are predating on the sturgeon? And if so, you mentioned salmonid predation, but what do you know about the sturgeon part, if you do?
If I do is the key point there. I know that stellars are primarily observed to be preying on sturgeon as opposed to Californias. I wouldn't say that you never have Californias preying on sturgeon. But I know where we're really seeing the issue is with the stellars. And I know in the Willamette below the falls, this is a real concern, particularly because there's not a lot of monitoring and the stellars are very mobile in the lower Willamette there below the falls. So the estimates of sturgeon predation are minimums because they don't have great, ODFW doesn't have great monitoring in place. So I think they're concerned that the impacts to sturgeon there especially are even more than we know.
Yeah, that seems to be a growing concern. If I may, Commissioner Thorburn has her hand up, Christina.
Christina, that was a great response. Chair Carpenter, we have our annual sturgeon report, and with the coming later today, and with the recently revised commission policy, we asked for sturgeon and pinniped consumption of sturgeon, and I think that's included in the report that's coming up today.
Yes, thank you very much for that, Commissioner Thorburn. I appreciate it. I did know it was coming, but not the state of detail that you did.
All right, thank you. Some great questions and great points. So the increasing abundance for both species has followed this similar pattern. You have a small number of animals habituate to a location. Recruitment of other animals occurs, and these are social animals. So where you have one or two more tend to arrive. Habituated animals generally arrive earlier and remain at sites longer, and they seem to habituate easily and return to the sites year after year. Next slide. Substantial efforts have been made over the years to non-lethally deter pinnipeds at Bonneville Dam to get them to move away from these pinch points where the salmon are staged up and give the fish a chance to move through the dam. So both dam-based and boat-based hazing has been conducted. And you know, there are always robust safety guidelines in place, including those for fish. When you have 1,000 fish per day passing over the dam, you can't use seal bombs in the tail race due to potential harm to the fish. So over the years, there was a tremendous amount of information gathered about how and when hazing was used and what the sea lions were doing before and after the hazing events in order to document the effectiveness. And in summary, this slide puts it pretty bluntly with the thumbs down, that none of the hazing methods have been effective with the exception of putting in physical barriers to keep the animals out of the fish ladders. Everything else creates a temporary effect at best, but the food reward is just too strong and the animals return to foraging almost immediately after hazing. Next slide. Oh, thanks. I see Commissioner Smith's hand up.
Mr. Smith, I was reading. Go ahead.
I know that we haven't had this kind of large scale permit that we're after now, but do we have any data on whether any of the past removals have been, I mean, your chart that you just showed prompted me to wonder if there's any data on if removals are actually successful, you know, and over what period of time?
I think that's a great question. As I move through the history of what we have been able to do to date and what the constraints have been around that, I think what that might demonstrate is why removals haven't been more effective to date. So that might be kind of a circular way of getting at what you're asking, I think, Commissioner Smith. So,
So they haven't been effective because they haven't been large scale enough. Is that what you're saying? But are we looking at that issue? Are we going to get data on that?
Yeah, I think we will be looking to quantify the expected benefits of this permit, and part of that will tell us what the effects are and if it is having an effect, if we are able to reduce predation. We know that a sea lion not present is eating fewer fish than a sea lion that is present. But the matter of scale, I think that's what we'll be looking to quantify.
But, you know, obviously I was getting at other sea lions move in after a period of time, right? So,
Yeah, I think I'm going to try and address that a little bit in the slides that okay. are coming. And maybe when I get to the end, if I haven't, we can come back to that. So, I want to just give a brief history of the removal program in the Columbia. So we've talked about the history of the problem and attempts at non-lethal deterrence, which hopefully helps you understand the process we went through to get to the point where we were seeking lethal removal authority. So in the early 2000s, predation at Bonneville was evaluated and hazing measures were tested. In 2006, the states requested authorization to lethally remove California sea lions at Bonneville Dam. The ensuing years saw our authorization was granted, it was litigated, appealed, we reapplied, and were reauthorized, and removals were occurring during those years. And then in 2018, NOAA authorized ODFW to lethally remove sea lions at Willamette Falls. So prior to 2020, our removal authority contained these conditions. Each California sea lion had to be individually identifiable, which required the animal hauling out onto a trap. The animal was marked with a permanent brand, and then the animal was released. Following that, that sea lion must be observed at Bonneville Dam for 5 days and must be observed eating a salmon at Bonneville Dam. And had to be subjected to hazing. And you had to confirm all of that by being able to read that brand that had been given to the animal. And so under those, well, could you go back 1 second, Scott?
Sorry.
That's okay. No, I appreciate the being tuned in. So once we met all of these conditions here, once an individual sea lion met those criteria, that data and a request to include the animal on the removal list would be made to NOAA Fisheries. NOAA Fisheries would review that data and decide if the animal should be included on the removal list. And then if NOAA did add that animal to the removal list, then if that animal again hauled out onto a trap and could be retrapped, then it would be removed from the system. So that was the criteria under our previous authorization. Okay, now next slide. So under those conditions, these are the numbers of California sea lions that were removed through 2019. So a total of 215 animals between 2008 and 2019. I guess over 10 years since we didn't remove any in 2008. Next slide. So in December of 2018, Congress passed an amendment to the MMPA that Nate alluded to, specific to pinnipeds in the Columbia River preying on endangered salmon. the eligible entities, which included the three states, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, and a consortium of tribal co-managers, submitted an application under this amended MMPA in June of 2019, and in August of 2020, NOAA Fisheries authorized the permit. Next slide. So what the amended act provides for is place-based safe zones for salmon. Also includes protection for sturgeon and lamprey, and allows us to take proactive action based on the presence of sea lions in those safe zones. It also includes tribal co-management, which is a vital partnership for this work. Next slide, thanks. So the specific conditions of the permit includes Steller sea lions as well as California sea lions, no more than 540 California sea lions and 176 Stellars will be taken over the entire 5-year period of the permit. And that represents essentially our estimate of how many animals are in the river system above River Mile 112. And so the geographic scope of the application is the main stem Columbia from River Mile 112, which is the Interstate 205 bridge in Portland, to River Mile 292, which is McNary Dam, as well as any tributary to the Columbia, even below River Mile 112, that includes spawning habitat of ESA-listed salmon or steelhead. And so the idea there is that, again, as Nate alluded to earlier, that, you know, we have decades of data saying, or a couple decades of data saying, sea lions in these areas are coming this far upriver and they're following a salmon run and they're having an impact at these artificial impoundments. And that case has been made based on the established data. So the amended act declares those areas a safe zone for salmon, as opposed to making the individual case sea lion by individual sea lion. The conditions also include that a plan be approved for humane method for capture and removal to be reevaluated annually. Next slide. So as part of describing the problem in our permit application, we essentially had to categorize where the issue is kind of the gravest, the most serious, the worst. And as you can see, and when I say we, the crew that includes ODFW, Idaho Fish and Game, CRITFIC, and WDFW plan to really concentrate our efforts at Bonneville, and ODFW will prioritize Willamette Falls initially. We think that addressing the populations of animals that are gathering at those impoundments will have benefits in the tributaries as well, because as I said, we think that those are the same animals that are foraging from those locations. Next slide. So the expected benefit of this expanded authorization, we think that being able to act in this place-based way will allow us to reduce predation on these ESA-listed stocks of salmon, steelhead, as well as sturgeon by Steller sea lions, which we really have not been able to address before. We think by not having to mark and repeatedly handle and document these animals, we'll be able to be more efficient in this removal program. And being able to be proactive in that way, we expect to be able to prevent sea lions from habituating to these locations. And the idea is less habituation means less of that social recruitment that we see, so that we would expect that we would be headed to fewer removals over time by being able to be more proactive. And how we will be looking to quantify that, again, based on the reduction in the number of animals and the length of time these animals are at these pinch points. And we know based on some bioenergetics work, approximately what the number, as well as observations, what number of salmon we think they're eating. So we'll be able to arrive at estimates of how many fish essentially are saved by not having those sea lions present. And we have an excellent example of this at Willamette Falls. ODFW removed 33 California sea lions in 2019 in an effort to save a winter steelhead run that was down to about 500 fish. As a result of removing those 33 animals in 2019, there were no California sea lions at the falls from August of 2019 to March of 2020. And predation dropped between 2017 and 2020 from, as you can see, 21 to 25% to more like 1 or 2%. So you had almost 1,400 steelhead saved out of a total run of about 5,500. And that extinction probability dropped dramatically down to 11% in 2019 and I think even further in 2020. We just don't have that number yet. So the implementation so far, the spring season for trapping at Bonneville was canceled due to COVID issues. Just the necessity of the close proximity folks work in. There just wasn't a way to that we felt we could do it safely, and staff safety is always the first priority. So there was no spring season in the fall of 2020. With the new authorization, then the Iyakuk, the protocols were approved. And again, slow start in the fall due to COVID, wildfire smoke delayed work at Bonneville for several weeks. And then staff were able to get out for a few weeks in October and November and start removing just a very few Steller sea lions. This is a learning process for our teams who haven't worked with Stellers before. They're larger. They behave differently. So again, with safety as the first priority, it's kind of a slow start, but this is where we are right now with this new authorization, and the Bonneville work will resume this spring. And now I think it's back to Scott, back to Puget Sound.
I'm going to switch and talk a little about some research we've been doing, and we, meaning Joe Anderson, who will speak in a minute, and myself, and then working with Ben Nelson. This is work that was been funded by a variety of our own funding, as well as Long Live the Kings and others. And before I delve into it too far, I just wanna point out that we're looking at this very simply. So we're looking at harbor seals and we're looking at their impact on salmon over on the left. So I've intentionally put in a picture of salmon to show you where they are in this food web and where harbor seal is in the food web. And I think it's important to recognize it's a complex food web. And right now we're doing very simple modeling, looking at this sort of linear relationship. But we know there are all these indirect effects, and we don't know how those indirect effects work in the system very well. There is an Atlantis modeling effort that's being undertaken right now by NOAA. And I think the early results of that will be out shortly. And that's the kind of model which will allow us to say, okay, well, what happens if I turn the dial on this species or on this species? How does it affect the others? So I just wanted that to serve as a prelude. Our research is building on the work by Brandon Chasko. And in 2016, he did a bioenergetics model. And there were two papers that came out of that. I was a co-author on one of those. We estimated consumption of Chinook salmon from 1970 to 2015. We modeled population size, diet, energetic demands for killer whales, California sea lions, Steller sea lions, and harbor seals. And based on that modeling, we estimated that Chinook consumed by pinnipeds increased from 68 to 625 metric tons over time, that period of time, and that pinnipeds were consuming more than killer whales in all the fisheries combined. Well, of course, that made a lot of people concerned. And we wanted to take Brandon's work, which is a nice initial start in the modeling, and carry it to the next level. And we wanted to use, Brandon was forced to use older population estimates because he didn't have the 2019 data. So the previous point to that was quite a ways back in time because surveys have not been funded for quite a while. We had new diet data for the Puget Sound. We wanted to use a similar modeling approach, but we wanted to account for uncertainty through the model. So propagate that uncertainty up through the model. We wanted to be able to express smolt consumption as a fraction of total abundance. We wanted to examine the sensitivity to different assumptions about salmon prey size, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And we didn't want to model beyond our geographic or temporal scope of our data, which Brandon did. So we really wanted to focus just on this space that you see here. Working with the co-managers and with Western Washington, we collected scats throughout this whole area between 2016 and 2018, and ended up with a lot of poop, 1,946 samples, which is always great. Scientists love samples. And as a result, we can, just one thing about the fecal samples, before I go into the results, we're using, the feces comes in and we can learn kind of, we can use two different approaches to learn what's in that. One is we use now a molecular approach, and we're looking at the percent DNA by species. And when we do that, we find out they eat a lot of things. Over 60 species were identified in this space and that window being consumed by harbor seals. And a lot of the other species, particularly clupeids, so things like herring, tomcod, a variety of other species are very important to harbor seals. And we're mostly focusing on that sort of spring window when the juvenile are migrating out. The other piece of information we have are the hard parts in the feces. And if we can look at those hard parts and learn a little bit about the animal, and I'll talk about more of that in just a minute. So we're trying to reconstruct diet, and we used a month as our timestamp, and we really wanted to have over 70 feces, ideally over 100 per month, because of sample size issues and our power to be able to detect change over time. And what we found was that the mean, you can see here, are the percent of the diet composed of Chinook and Coho, Chinook on top, Coho on the bottom. And these are mostly juvenile fish. So in general, similar to Brandon, we're finding about 2 to 4% of the diet of the harbor seal is composed of those juvenile fish. And what was interesting is that we see this difference among years for Chinook. 2016 looks really different than 17 and 18. I can't say what a typical year is with only three. You know, whether one is anomalous or not, I don't know. We would have to have a lot more information, but you can see it does vary among years, and it varies a little bit among months. What's interesting with Coho is it's remarkably similar among years, almost identical, with very little variation. And so now here we're actually looking at the proportion of the juveniles eaten. So we're moving from the percent of the diet to the proportion. And so a 2.2 means 20% of those juvenile fish are being eaten. 0.4 means 40% of those fish are being eaten. And we're looking at Chinook on top, Coho on the bottom. And you might say, okay, well, what's going on here with this open water versus near shore? Brandon, when he did his work, he assumed that the size of the fish he used size of fish from beach seining. And we said, okay, well, what if the harbor seal is eating out in the midwater? And so we used midwater trawl data coming from Ricker cruises, and you get radically different answers if you use the midwater trawl data. So if you use the open water data, which is the green dots, you can see that our estimates are reduced by at least half by going from one estimate to the other based on the size of fish. So we go from very similar results to what Brandon was getting to very different results depending on fish size. So we then said, okay, well, what can we learn based on what the animals are telling us they're eating? So we can look at their otoliths in the feces. And from those otoliths, measurements of length and height of the otolith, we can estimate how big the fish is. And when we do that, we find it's much more like that open water estimate in terms of fish size being consumed. And so you run, if you sort of look at these bullets at the bottom, in terms of near shore, you can see that eating a lot of fish. And as you go down to the offshore, it drops down dramatically. And if you go to the otolith-derived fish size, it drops down even more dramatically. And this has to do with what you see here with that. Here you're looking at the otoliths, and Brandon's work is assuming the sort of near shore size distribution, which is right here. And so your diet, you can either be eating one large fish or you can be eating a whole bunch of little fish. And that becomes really important if you're estimating the impact on juvenile salmon. And what we're finding in the otoliths is this bimodal distribution where they're eating these juveniles, but they're also eating these other fish out here that are bigger. And those are likely blackmouth salmon. And so those are one-year-olds and two-year-olds that are resident species in Puget Sound. So what have we learned? We learned that our diet analysis suggests that harbor seals in Puget Sound could consume anywhere between 0.33 to 13 million juvenile salmon. So 13 is much closer to what Brandon came up with. Under our assumptions on fish size, it could be reduced. If the impacts in all of our work, it's their diffuse impacts. So they're not eating a lot, but it's a lot of animals eating very little that adds up. And the other thing I want to point out is that a lot of our salmon, the vast majority of the scats came in showed that they're eating zero. So most of the scats come in with no juvenile salmon in the scat.
Scott, if I may, Vice Chair Baker has a question.
Sure.
Thank you, Scott. So it looks to me like you get different data depending on at least where you test the waters on these things and possibly at what time of year. Do you all take that into account? And do you go into especially like river mouths when the salmon are spawning to see if the seals are eating either the fish going upriver or downriver? So you were talking about open water and near shore. I'm asking about river mouths.
Right. That's a really good question. Our work right here that I'm talking about is looking at the impact on juvenile salmon. So the out-migrating juvenile is not looking at adults. We're moving there next. So right now we're looking at sampling during that window of time when those young salmon are out-migrating. And why do we focus on that? Because that's what Brandon found is where the impact is. So we're building on Brandon's work. We found that there's this very large impact based on consumption of juvenile salmon. And so we focused on that. And in terms of our sample, we try to distribute that really well in space and time. And we try to get both haulouts that are both near shore and offshore. It's hard to know exactly because you're getting fecal matter and that fecal matter has to be deposited on land, logs, rafts, whatever the land is. You're really relying on the places where the animals haul out. And you hope that by collecting that sample over that large space, over that period of time, that you end up with a representative sample. Our next goal is to look at the adults. And we'll be doing that shortly because we ended up collecting samples year round. And we're gonna be now looking at the adult consumption as well.
We have two more hands up, Scott. We have Commissioner Anderson and then Commissioner McKaysey, please. Commissioner Anderson. You got to unmute yourself, Jim.
Sorry about that. Commissioner Baker's comment got a lot to where I was going with my thoughts, and in that obviously you were looking at the juvenile, and we've got to get to the adult stage, and we also have to get into where, to me, the hot spots or critical areas are eventually, and it sounds like the plan is to be doing more studies to get to there. And I guess I just want to oppose the point that, I'd like to be able to use the best available science now as to look at ways that we might be able to do some necessary work to protect these very stocks before they go worse. We've in the Cedar River, for instance, I don't even know if we've got a viable steelhead population anymore because we were slow and we had a lot of problems with trying to get to doing something. And so I don't want to lose sight of the fact that we want to be proactive while at the same time doing all the good science that you're doing.
And that's exactly where we're going, is moving into sort of those estuaries of concern and the priority estuaries of concern. And the other thing is to use these samples. So the question is, if you have all these zeros and ones, you have places where you find their salmon in the diet and places where they're not. The question is, are there places where you find it that are coincident in space and time? if they are coincident in space and time, that would lead you to that place as a potential area where you might want to focus management. So that's exactly the area where we're going.
If I may, Scott, I have Commissioner McIsaac and then Commissioner Koontz. Commissioner McIsaac, please. Unmute yourself, Don.
Oh, okay, am I down here now? Okay. There, can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Could you move back to slide 45?
I can't.
And it caught my eye here on the Chinook side of this when you said that this is a proportion of the juveniles that are eaten. And in 2017, I see a dot there at 0.4, which made me think, is that 40% of the juveniles in the area that are eaten?
Yes.
And I wondered how you got your the numbers that were present in the area. I wondered about your SCAT analysis. Your
call outs, not your. Yeah. Don, do you have two computers on? Do you have two computers on, Don?
I think I got his question.
Okay.
The one question, first of all, is in 2017. I don't know if you can see my cursor. So the question is.
Are you able
to
hear any of that?
Yes. I think I got your question. Let me see. Let me try to answer and let me know if I got it or not. But the question is, in 2017, you see a dot of 0.4. Yes, that's estimating that about 40% of the run is being eaten, of the juveniles are being eaten. And that's using that nearshore diet. If you use that offshore diet, it's actually lower than 20%, somewhere between 10 and 20%. So it depends on the fish size. Getting to your the next question, well, how do we know how many fish there are? And we're going to answer that in a minute with Joe will be answering that. I think that was your next question.
Scott, I can jump in real quick here. So it's a pretty simple fraction here, Commissioner McIsaac. You know, the numerator is the estimate of juvenile salmon consumed. The denominator is the estimate of total juvenile salmon that are out there, hatchery plus natural origin. So we used our information from our rotary screw traps that estimate the total outmigration of natural origin juvenile Chinook and coho salmon, and then added that to our hatchery releases. So we're estimating sort of all the fish that are out there, hatchery plus natural origin, what are the fraction that are being consumed?
Okay, and so that's the fraction. I'm getting some feedback here. Anyway, that's the number of fish that leaves the tributaries as opposed to what's in the sound.
Yeah.
Correct. Right. Yes. Because what is really difficult to track is what is the abundance of the sort of resident age one, age two fish, the black mouth that are out there. So that's one of the reasons, Scott is showing that the modeling of fraction consumed is really sensitive to the size of the prey. And so if you look at it and you sort of assume they're all eating smolt size fish, that number gets really large and ends up being a really large fraction of the total abundance. If you assume that they're eating sort of black mouth sized fish, then that fraction or fish that are older have made that transition to offshore, it ends up being a much smaller fraction of the fish.
That answer your question, Don?
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Koontz has a question.
First of all, great research. I think it's fabulous you're doing this kind of research. One question I have is, there's quite a variation between 0.33 and 13 million or whatever. Mm-hmm. And what I'm wondering is, do we have any idea how that compares to birds or other fish or even other human impacts on mortality?
Unfortunately, we do not on juvenile fish, outmigrating juvenile fish.
Do we, do we have any comparison, say, on loss through dams?
That might be available.
Okay, maybe that's something to look at. Then here's another question, and I'm not a fish person, so it's maybe show my ignorance. But, you know, it seems like life of a salmon sure is hard. You know, there's so many little smolts, and they kind of go out there in the world and do their thing and then come back. And the way Mother Nature made it, I guess not that many come back, and that keeps it going. But, you know, for at least the last 20 years, that number of return, you know, smolts to adult return, you know, it's like 2% or something, right? So my question is, the impact that the pinnipeds are having, is that like additive, or, you know, those smolts have maybe died anyway, you know, like, is it additive or compensatory?
Well, we're going to talk about that in just a second.
So okay, great.
Maybe super. we'll talk about that.
Super. Thank you.
Yeah. Should I keep going, or there's some more questions?
If I can get unmuted. No, we're good to go at the moment, Scott. Thank you very much.
Okay. So because it's so sensitive, our models to fish size, we're really focusing in terms of evaluating the impact on juvenile is trying to get more information on fish size. And so what we're doing is saying, okay, let's use another structure. So another hard part in the feces. And if you think about it, a fish has two otoliths, but it's got over 30 vertebrae, all of which, you know, have that potential to be recovered. And so right now, the relationships between fish size, length, and the vertebrae measurements have not been established. And so we're doing that right now. So we're working with Bill Walker, a whole bunch of fish have been filleted from small to big. All of those have been prepared. He's measured them all now. And now we're coming up with that, that new measurement. And that'll give us a whole bunch more information about fish size. And in addition, through his work, we're finding that we can also distinguish Chinook vertebrae from all the other salmon vertebrae. So we don't have to just say, oh, this is what the salmon distribution looks like. But because the Chinook are distinct, we can say this is what the Chinook size distribution looks like from the vertebrae. So that's exciting area of research, new stuff that'll be really interesting. So now what we're going to do is we're going to switch gears. I can't remember, Joe, are you going to give this one or am I?
I think you were okay. Up on this slide, and I'm taking the baton after that.
Okay. So remember from Nate's presentation, he talked about the potential biological removal, and that's based on that minimum population size. So PBR here stands for that potential biological removal, and min is that minimum population size, and then you have the stocks. And this is for harbor seals. And when you do those calculations, you can see how many can be removed. That's 88 from Hood Canal, 68 from Puget Sound. You know, this is really South Puget Sound. In the northern inland, 464. But remember, that's all the take. So that's take from fisheries, that's take from everything. I just want to reemphasize that point that Nate brought up earlier. So now we can take that PBR and we can bring it forward into calculations. And I'll let Joe take over at this point.
Yes. So thanks, Scott and commissioners for the opportunity this afternoon. And so what I'm going to try to do here is answer a really important question, which is all the juvenile consumption that we've just described to you. What does that mean in terms of adult returns? And it's a tough question to answer. So I'm going to make a series of simplifying assumptions, and I want to walk you through those just so we can get to something that's sort of manageable and digestible in terms of numbers on the next slide. So first, we did our estimates here based on the South Sound seal stock, because that stock of seals best overlaps the diet data that we have from 2016 to 2018 that Scott was just describing. So we talked about three size distributions of those salmon prey. And so I'm just going to look at those near size or those near shore size distributions. And so just as a reminder, that results in the most numerous estimates of fish consumed. And it also sort of best matches our information on salmon smolt adult survival, because that sampling approach really approximates a smolt or a juvenile salmon as it exits the river and it heads into Puget Sound. I just looked at the median estimates of the juveniles consumed, acknowledging that we showed you a range and a whole lot of uncertainty there. But just to keep things simple, I'm going to focus on the median. And then secondly, we made some assumptions about salmon marine survival after the salmon were exposed to seal predation. And I'm showing you some numbers here. You see the term SAR that refers to smolt to adult return rate. So 0.68% for Chinook salmon, 5% for coho salmon. So I would describe these estimates of marine survival as optimistic in the sense that they're a little bit above the average of what we've sort of seen from our natural populations and our hatchery populations in recent years. And again, I'm sort of leaning towards sort of translating the juveniles into a larger number of adults just to sort of put this in context. I didn't really model any variance in salmon survival. Salmon survival does bounce around quite a bit. So I'm sort of not capturing that uncertainty. Just to try to keep things simple. And then lastly, I'm going to show you different levels of compensatory mortality. And so this is what Commissioner Kuntz alluded to in his question. And it's really a sort of a critical aspect here. And it's kind of a case study in aspects of predator control. So a situation of 0% compensatory mortality means that in a situation of which we've reduced the predator consumption by removing predators, all of the juvenile salmon that we quote unquote saved would have survived at the rates above. So that's a situation of 100% additive mortality. You can sort of think of mortality from different sources as modular. It's sort of plug and play sort of situation. On the far end of the spectrum would be a situation of 100% compensatory mortality. And what that means is that the salmon that were eaten by these hypothetical seals that we've now removed would have died anyway. And so you might think about this if the seals are, say, picking out the diseased or the sick or the injured salmon, that they're going to be more vulnerable to other predators. Or maybe the act of removing the seals releases a different salmon predator from predation, say hake, and the hake then consume the salmon. So it's a bit of a mind bender to sort of wrap your head around. It's sort of a hypothetical scenario. But in our opinion, it's really important for expressing the complexity of the ecosystem and sort of the uncertainty that would result from any sort of seal removal action. So, yep, Scott, thank you. And so just going to walk through this table here, and this is just sort of showing those estimates. So again, we're talking about the South Sound harbor seals population. So the estimate there is 2,417 seals. Potential biological removal for that group is 68 seals. And you see in the table below that, I've got the 3 years for the diet data, 2016, 17, and 18, for each of the two salmon species. You can see our estimate of the median number of juvenile salmon consumed. And then if I apply those survival rates that I showed you in a previous slide under a situation of 0% compensatory mortality, you see the numbers there from hundreds to maybe 1,500 or so fish. On the far side, I'm showing the 100% compensatory mortality in which there's really no gain in adults saved. And in the middle, I've got the 50% mortality or compensatory mortality scenario, which is essentially just halfway in between the two there. So in truth, it's really hard to calculate compensatory mortality according to these percentages. I sort of deliberately put in this range all the way down to zero adults just to emphasize that there's really no guarantee in a response from the salmon population with any kind of sea removal. And then lastly, I think a really important point to make here, just to reiterate something that Scott emphasized, is that what we've modeled and what we're describing here is a really diffuse impact of the seals on the salmon. You've got a lot of seals. The salmon represent a very small proportion of the diet of each of those seals. And so when you remove a relatively small number of seals, 68 is less than 5% of that population estimate of around 2,400. The ultimate impact on the salmon saved is relatively small as we've sort of modeled and described it.
Anybody have any questions at this point for Joe?
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't see hands.
I see Commissioner Smith. Yeah.
Commissioner Smith, yep.
So I realize this is all, science-based conjecture, if you will. It seems like a lot of work and effort for a fairly small return, but given where our fish are in crisis, I guess it could be worth it, and that's what we're looking at. But if by some miracle, let's say we took down a bunch of dams and salmon numbers started coming back up, this would be a less important part of what was going on out there, I guess, right?
Sure. I think what I'm hearing your question is, like, how significant are these numbers of adults that I'm showing on this table? Does 800, 900, 1500 salmon really, would that make a big difference in our, in our sort of progress towards recovery? And really, you know, the key question there is, are these natural origin or hatchery origin salmon? Because our recovery goals are set around our natural origin and wild populations. And even our fisheries, while they're typically targeting our hatchery stocks, they're actually constrained by impacts to natural origin fish. And so the question kind of becomes, are the seals eating the hatchery origin fish or the natural origin fish? And that's a tough one. We don't really have a lot of real direct information on that topic. You know, there are possibly clues in the scats, you know, looking for some of the tags that we implant at hatcheries. That's kind of a needle in the haystack exercise. I don't think it's likely to be fruitful at sort of the numbers of samples we're talking about. We might be able to look at some of those otoliths to see if they have growth patterns that are indicative of hatchery rearing versus natural rearing. That's one possible avenue, but again, we don't have this. A lot of them tend to be kind of digested and difficult to decipher. You know, the main point that I would make here, and Scott, if you don't mind going back to the timing graph of the diet data, the real difference between the natural origin and the hatchery origin Chinook salmon, at least in Puget Sound, is the timing that they enter Puget Sound. So the smolts for the wild Chinook salmon, it's a really a protracted migration. We are actually installing our smolt traps right now, and we're catching fish right off the bat in January. That will continue through June and July, even August in some places. By contrast, the hatchery origin fish are largely, not exclusively, but most of them are released in a pretty discrete pulse in about 2 to 3 weeks in May. And so one of the big surprising results that I've seen so far, if you look at that top graph, you don't really see a big spike in the percentage of Chinook salmon in the seal diets right around May, when most of the hatchery origin fish are released, and numerically they dominate. They're about an order of magnitude more numerous than the natural origin fish. So I personally found that surprising, given there's so many more smolts available all of a sudden right in May. You know, why are we not seeing a bigger signal in the seal diets? And actually, the hatchery and the wild timing for coho is a lot more similar. They're really kind of right on top of each other in sort of mid-May to mid-April. And you can see that the coho percentage in the diet goes from virtually nothing in February and March, and then it sort of ticks up there in April, May, and June.
Joe, before I go to Commissioner McIsaac, I have a question about the competition for food. When you talk about, I think you said a 4% the Chinook consumption by the harbor seals is probably 4% of their diet. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Well, the other 96%, how much of that is the same forage that the salmon are striving to consume? And what the competition between herring and needlefish? And so do you have any thoughts or analyses on that?
That's a really good question. I think one of the things Scott and I've talked a lot about is looking for associations in the diet. And that the seals, it looks like they key on sort of a body type and sort of search image. Our colleague Steve Jeffries always taught me that they're looking for 8-inch shiny fish. And that could be a sand lance, it could be a herring, it could be anything that fits that category. And in his opinion, the seals aren't necessarily targeting salmon. It feels as though the salmon are sort of mixed in with some of these more abundant forage fish. And that's how these consumption events occur. But I would say we also have more work to do with the diet data. And I think there's some clues to be uncovered there in terms of, that type of work, looking for associations in the diet data.
Thank you. Commissioner McIsaac.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Sounds great. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So I was looking at these Chinook numbers and they seemed kind of small to me. I looked at 2018, 200,000 and 201,000, but I look up above at the 68 seals. This is just for South Sound. and there's 2,400 seals, but the numbers below only reflect what was consumed by the 68. Is that the right way to read this?
That's correct. That's correct. Our concept here was that if we, you know, in working with Nate and Scott, that if we were able to sort of max out the removal at the sort of legally allowed level, and I would defer to Nate on the MMPA aspect of this question. If we remove those 68 seals, given that's the upper limit of what we could do under the MMPA, what could we expect in a sort of benefit to the salmon population?
Okay, so if one was just wondering, well, how many total smolts are eaten by the 2,400? If you use that ratio of 24/17 over 68, my little calculator says 7.1 million Chinook smolts would be eaten by all the seals in this, but just the South Sound. And so I don't know where South Sound boundary is. Is that just Olympia, or is that the Deschutes and the Nisqually, or what is that?
So I would defer to Scott because it's the seal stock boundary. I believe it goes up to sort of Tacoma Narrows, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But Commissioner McIsaac, I think Scott astutely sort of pointed you back to this slide. What you're asking is what we aim to do exactly on this particular slot, this particular slide, where, you know, we're estimating the, you know, the total number given the entire seal population. The trick is that our study didn't exactly match the spatial geographic boundaries of that seal stock. And that's why the numbers are slightly different. But if you look down at the bottom there, that nearshore estimate, you know, the range there is, you know, 5 million to 13 million fish, which I think is right in alignment with the numbers that, you know, you're finding with your calculator.
Yeah. Okay. I see that now. Thank you.
Yep. You're welcome.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner McIsaac, just, I think kind of even going back to Commissioner Smith's question, we ran the estimate of adult equivalent saved under a removal of PBR just as a hypothetical. I want to assure you, we don't have an application in the works. We did this because there's so much interest on what can be done, and part of the governor's killer whale task force and discussions at North of Falcon, the commission position statement directing us to examine this issue. And so you're absolutely right. Harbor seals, a handful of them, there's a lot of salmon smolts that are eaten. But then when you apply the layer of the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and if you were to hypothetically remove at the administrative ceiling, you might result in saving, you know, 800 to 1600 Chinook in South Sound. And when I've asked fish managers about, is that a game changer, and across the different rivers, it isn't. It's probably within the observed interannual variation of returns. So that leads us to our next question. People have talked about hotspots and estuaries of concern. If we were to have several hundred additional adults returning at some watersheds of real concern, like the Stillaguamish or the Nooksack or the Elwha, all of a sudden that is of potential management interest. And so that's really goes to that next series of questions that we've requested funding for in the 21-23 operating budget that's being deliberated by the legislature this winter.
Joe, are you still on here?
I think if we're moving past the sort of seal removal question, I've passed the baton back to...
Okay, Scott. Yeah. A question, and I'm not using a calculator, and I'm using kind of an old tired brain, but 33 million smolts, I saw that number up there. And if I do that, you know, simple math says, in theory, it wouldn't be actual, but in theory, that could be 330,000 potential adults returning back, potentially. So that's one issue. You can comment on it if you have some thoughts on it. The other thing that I'll bring up, I mentioned it before, spent most of my life and my career in and around the San Juan Islands, and the biomass abundances of forage fish, primarily herring, needlefish, etc., has declined by a magnitude of a lot in the San Juan Islands. So the fact that these harbor seals are consuming more bright, shiny 7-8 inch juvenile Chinook and coho is a bigger problem, I think, than perhaps we realize as far as providing forage for them as juvenile salmon and then maturing salmon certainly as well. You know, as the population of increase on harbor seals so dramatically, I think there might have been a real consumption issue on the forage fish that perhaps we need to give some thought to as well. So thank you.
Good point. No, I agree completely. And there's, you know, pretty good evidence, Corey Green's work, Casey Rice's work, as you look at forage fish and their distribution and change over time, and you go from the north where there's a lot more forage fish, herring, sand lance, et cetera, and smelt. And then as you go further south, there gets to be less and less. And by the time you get south sound, the area we're working, the forage fish to seals at that point becomes dominated by salmon, because the biomass down in South Sound, when they're doing these trawls, becomes dominated by things like salmon and then other species like jellies. So it just suggests a system that's really out of whack.
Yeah, I just think there's some linkage that hopefully over time we can have a chance to drill down on a little bit.
No, I agree.
Thank you, Scott.
Good point. So just briefly, and this is something we haven't done a lot with yet, and now that we have Casey Clark on as our new researcher on marine mammals, I'm hoping that he'll be able to move this forward, but we did start to look at California sea lion diet, and we looked, first thing we have is some information on inland marine water sea lion abundance estimates from 2013, 14, and 15, and that's Bob DeLong's work, as well as some aerial surveys that Steve did. And we find that in general per month, it ranges from, you know, a low in some months is down to 110 animals, all the way up close to 1,000 animals. And then we collected a lot of scats, or a fair number of scats, between 2009 and 2017, because our sample sizes were somewhat limited, we had to pool a lot of our data. We ended up with data from Manchester, Commencement Bay, Caroline Beach in the south, and Bremerton. And we were able to pool the data and look at November, February consumption, and then spring, summer consumption. And we find that California sea lions, when they're here in the intermarine waters, they're eating a lot of chum. 21% of their diet was adult chum, then northern anchovy, and walleye pollock, and herring. And then in terms of the salmon species of concern, we're seeing that in terms of Chinook, they're eating about 4.6% of their diet, and then steelhead is 0.56% of their diet, so a very small percent of their diet. Their diet varied spatially. We found that in Bremerton, Caroline Beach, and Nisqually, they're eating a lot of chum. But if you go to Manchester, then they're eating more herring. And if you go to Commencement Bay, then anchovy became important. So that's that spatial variability, which we expect in these pinnipeds. An interesting thing was we did find Atlantic salmon in the diet in Manchester at 5% and Bremerton at 11%. And I haven't had a chance to think about this very much and think about where that Atlantic salmon is coming from. Went back too far.
Gotta put my hand up.
Question?
Oh, I was gonna say, well, there were Atlantic salmon net pens right there, you know. Right. I don't know if those have been taken out yet or not, but probably some escapees.
Well, part of it may be environmental DNA. So when you're grabbing a feces off a net pen, you're going to grab the DNA that's in the feces, but also if there's a net pen there, that Atlantic salmon DNA will be on the surface. So, you know, look at that Atlantic salmon information with a lot of caution.
Yeah.
Commissioner Anderson has his hand up, Scott.
Yeah,
real brief question. Just the diet issue spurred the thought that with a decreased chum salmon in the past several years, there's obviously something's going to give. Either we're going to see sea lions leaving, trying to find food elsewhere, or they're going to be going to some alternative. And I'm, you know, this is interesting, and maybe there's no bright answer, but you know, obviously they're going to be looking for something else if there's no chum. And so there you go. There's a good example of incremental change or effect.
And in recent years, in certain places, Commencement Bay is a good one, where we've had these really large aggregations of anchovy. And if you have a lot of anchovy in these giant schools, and it's amazing to watch, because you will end up with a lot of California sea lions going into those schools, then they're going to consume them, because it's, you know, easy to get, easy prey. It's very concentrated and it's really energy rich. So a lot of good reason to eat anchovy. The other thing we're doing, getting at Nate's point about, we need to understand where the predation is occurring. And what we're doing is using our at-sea surveys, which we've been doing it for a long time, mostly for birds. But while we're doing those transects, we record all species encountered. So we have XY locations of every animal encountered. And we can start to, we're now working with UW, folks at UW, to develop these predicted density surfaces, if you will, these hot spot maps where you have high densities and lower densities of animals. And we're currently working on that. And we're hoping that will help inform that question of where are these animals? And are there places that overlap with places we're very concerned about? So this will help move us in that direction. And the last thing I want to just briefly talk about is the Hood Canal Impact Assessment and Action Plan. This is a lot of partners being driven by Long Live the Kings primarily. Our tribal partners, Washington State Department of Transportation, and others. And we've been looking at the impacts of Hood Canal, and particularly on steelhead. And what we found in this report's out, it's available on the web. We can also make sure you all get a copy of it. But we found the bridge really impedes fish passage and also affects water quality parameters, temperature, salinity, currents, particularly near the bridge. When you look at this bridge, 83% of this bridge is a floating bridge. It also goes 15 feet underwater. So it's blocking movement of those surface waters. And steelhead tend to migrate in the surface layer. It appears that it's slowing the animals down. And based on mark recapture data of those steelhead, so they have acoustic tags on them, a really high percent of them, up to 40% of them, are dying at the bridge. And the bridge may be acting essentially as a block to them. And as a result, predators may be more effective in catching them there. And so as a result, we're moving into looking at structural modifications. So already working with professional engineers, and we're talking about solutions that we can bring in and test, where you actually have the solution there, if you will, in place for a while, and then you remove it for a while, and you look at the effects on survival of steelhead. And I think it's a really exciting way of moving to an action right away, evaluating that action, and then hopefully you can modify it and keep moving forward. So I think that's that. I'm going to pass this on to Nate.
Great. Thanks, Scott. And Mr. Chairman, I know we're approaching an hour and a half into an hour-long scheduled agenda item. I only have 73 more slides to go, so with me. And
I love you. I love you, Nate, just so you know.
You bet, Mr. Chair. So, on the non-lethal side of things, we've partnered with a group called Oceans Initiative, a really neat nonprofit. They received a grant to deploy an acoustic device, a startle device, at Ballard Locks this summer. And then we contracted them to deploy the device at Whatcom Creek Hatchery in Bellingham. And what they found by using this technology within a pretty small area of the signature of the sound signature of the device, that they saw a decrease in the observed predation rates of salmon by harbor seals by 45%. So pretty interesting results there of a smaller scale, but I think it's important that we continue to examine these non-lethal measures. These are the items that we can do under Section 109H of the Marine Mammal Protection Act and don't need to go through the extensive permitting process. Next slide, please, Scott. So we'll talk about some next steps. Next slide. Internally, it's been a ton of fun working with Scott, the Marine Mammal Team, and with with Joe. And what we've done here this fall is the director said, this is a pretty important issue for both avian and pinniped predation. And rather than kind of our engagement as catch can, let's formalize it. Let's establish this interdisciplinary team. Let's look at the different policy forums where these topics are coming up. Let's support the staff that are engaged in those forums. We need to examine as an agency, developing our predator prey principles, looking at even our staff structure and recommendations on how we're best deployed to address these issues, and then ultimately develop recommendations to secure funding and authorities to do this work. Transitioning to the budget request for this session, the commission approved back in August it was in a broader package, but it has two elements related to pinnipeds. First, there's a request for $1.5 million for us to do work on the Columbia River. This expands that removal program that we currently did under the previous permit that Cassina described from 2 months, now expanding to where we'd be working 10 months out of the year doing removals under the new Section 120F permit. We have a request for $940,000 to do that focused diet studies in Puget Sound and to be able to continue pinniped counts. There is a proviso being discussed right now on $140,000 that would be passed through to the Washington State Academy of Sciences to convene a panel of scientists to look at pinniped predation rates with an emphasis on the Washington portion of the Salish Sea and the Washington Outer Coast. And there is, in the capital budget, there is an investment for $70,000 for us to do some pre-design work in our South Sound Wildlife Area to expand and have a marine mammal laboratory there. So this would just be teeing up for a future capital request. Scott mentioned the Hood Canal project. In RCO's budget, there's $3.6 million to do some implementation there to help fish passage and allow for steelhead to outmigrate and stop having some of those eddies and entrapment where smolts are being consumed by avian and pinniped predators. So I think that's everything that we had to present today, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Anderson, I think we hit the mark of your blue sheet.
It's been really, really a good presentation by all. I see, Commissioner Anderson, do you have your hand up by mistake?
No, not by mistake, by design.
Okay, good. Well, I have Commissioner Smith and then you, and then we'll wrap this agenda item. Commissioner Smith.
Apologies if you hear the dogs in the background while my mic's on. So this is really a great presentation and really exciting science. And what's discouraging is, you know, it's not going to solve our problem with, you know, declining salmon stocks. So, you know, is there a cost benefit, you know, analysis that's been done looking at, you know, habitat improvement, including culvert removals, riparian restoration, tackling urban runoff, you know, and then there's climate change. Is there a big picture look at all of this that's been pulled together yet, or is that, you know, maybe still being done?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Smith, when I think about all the work that's been done in the Columbia River, where literally hundreds of millions of ratepayer and taxpayer dollars have gone into salmon recovery, and we have, looking across the four H's, we have either kind of paused, you know, worsening conditions, and or even turned the dial and made some gains in those H's. And so that's promising. But an area that has been unchecked has been pinniped predation. And I think that Cassina's example of Willamette Falls, where the probability of extinction of steelhead dropped from 80% to less than 10%, that's pretty compelling work to have that proceed. We're not in that kind of analysis from my perspective in Puget Sound. And And so I think that there's a lot of work to be done on understanding pinniped predation there, but then also putting it in that context of comparing it with other sources of mortality and looking at where is the best return on investment. You know, there's so much work to be done on the habitat side. Let's, you know, commission, help us find the political will to make the difference on the habitat side. But there's definitely a lot of political interest on pinniped predation.
Well, I'll try to wrap this up. You know, I believe that in response to Commissioner Smith too, that there have been a huge amount of work in terms of trying to pull together the state on Puget Sound salmon recovery. It's been a different, been decades in the works, and there's some really good work that the Puget Sound Partnership and others have done. And so I think we have a pretty good broad picture and a lot of understanding about the different elements. And as Nate said, pinnipeds is one piece that really hasn't gotten the attention. And I think that's what we're trying to do here. So I, you know, the comprehensive approach that the department is taking with regard to the science, I think is critical. And what you heard me urging is that we don't want to lose efforts that can be taken in the short term or the intermediate term in certain watersheds that can give us real relief in the short term without knowing fully all the science behind it. We do know and have some good understanding that there might be some things that we can do that will help our situation going forward. So, you know, the recommendations that Nate put out there were solid. I think there's one area that could maybe get a little more attention. That's the partnerships and the early action areas that we could engage people and try to make some differences while all the science is being fully put together. So I don't want to lose sight of the fact that we do need the studies. We have to do all of that to really advance totally, but we really do need, I think, some early action efforts. And I think we know what a lot of those areas are. So.
Thank you, Commissioner Anderson. Commissioner Thorburn.
I try to make it quick. Commissioner Smith, thanks for your observation and question, and Nate for the response as well as the observations that Commissioner Anderson made. I want to add, you know, in species of greatest conservation need, as particularly listed species and recovery plans, we often talk about a concept called umbrella species, in terms of a species of conservation need that we do recovery in an ecosystem, and that recovery lifts up other species as well. And so I'm thinking of the great work that the Killer Whale Task Force did on the ecosystem approaches to a threatened species and how that's added in. However, the killer whales, as well as the pinnipeds, are predators on this particular vulnerable species that we're talking about. And so I would just say, with that concept of umbrella species, a lot of the work that you're talking about, I think, has been thought about. But as Nate pointed out, the work on a pinniped and predation is kind of missing if we're looking at killer whales as an umbrella species for the ecosystem.
Okay, Nate, Joe, Scott, well done indeed. A lot more to know here in the near future, we hope. Thank you so much for all your work.
My pleasure, thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioners, that wraps up Commissioner Anderson's blue sheet agenda item 7. It is now nearly 3:30, and I'm looking at we got at least another hour and a half of agenda item 8 and 9. I wondered what you folks and Joe Podesco thought about Tomorrow, the day looks a little bit lighter, perhaps maybe even a little more than lighter, and about moving the executive session till tomorrow morning, about noon or somewhere when we get done. Any objections to that by anyone? Does that, I mean, okay, I guess that makes sense to people. There's no objections. Thank you for that. Okay, we'll go now.